Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Vikings in the East. From Vladimir the Great to Vladimir Putin, the origins of a contested legacy in Russia and Ukraine is a fascinating new book by Martin Wittok. It looks at the Vikings, because you may think of them as axe-wielding, hairy-chested people who come across from Denmark, Sweden, whatever, and, you know, worry the sheep in Lindisfarne. But Martin's going to tell us all about Vikings going east. And as the saying goes, Martin, what have the Vikings ever done for us?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. The Vikings have had a huge impact on the British Isles, a huge impact on communities either side of the North Sea. The founders of Normandy, which, of course, is the land of the Northmen, huge impact on Ireland, so not just on the UK, but also a huge, huge impact on the Baltic, the southern shore of the Baltic, and then down through the river systems of what we now call Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine, right to the Caspian Sea, to the Black Sea, to Constantinople, to Baghdad. Now, these are Vikings as we just don't imagine them at all. These are the Vikings of the East.
Indeed. And before we get cracking into this, because I tell you now, Martin, the listeners are going to be going, oh, for goodness sake, he's going to go on his historical thing again. But what's your background, by the way, for those who don't know you?
Okay, I taught high school, secondary school history in comprehensive schools in the UK for 35 years. And in that time, I began to write as well. And having retired a little early to start, give more time to writing, I've then progressed from writing for young people to writing for adults. And I would now describe myself as a freelance historian who's also a commentator and a columnist as well, commentating on the impact of the past on the present.
Absolutely. So we tend to think, because the narrative has always been from a British point of view, if you like, yeah, we know about the Normans, yes, because they like a fight. We know about the Vikings and Lindisfarne and Harald Hardrada, the Battle of Stamford Bridge, which we will come on to, not the battle, but somebody else in a bit. But this whole thing about, because people will go, hang on a second, how on earth are the Vikings going to get east? Their ship, you know, we know about the maybe, you know, Greenland, Eric the Red, etc., discovering the States, mourning Christopher Columbus. But how are they going to get, I mean, unless they're dragging the longboats across the land, we thought they're seafaring folk. But of course, we forget the river systems.
Exactly. These are Vikings of the rivers. So as they move along, and so primarily, Danish and Norwegian Vikings are mostly responsible for the activity to the west, not solely, but particularly. But Swedish Vikings are particularly involved in this movement into the Baltic. And of course, the Baltic is this Norse, Germanic, Slav, Balt Sea. And they are from the western side of it, and they are hugely influential, trading from Gotland and into the river systems. And from the river systems that flow into the Baltic, you can then get into the heart of the continent. And with a lot of effort, you can also port your boats from watershed to watershed, which we think happens. So we're not talking about perhaps a big, long ships with the dragon prows that kind of feature in Hollywood movies of the West. We're looking at smaller vessels. There's references to large dugout canoes, for example, being built by locals and then being sold to the Norse. These using the river systems being ported from over the watershed from one river system to another. But also there's more evidence now that in the winter they may have traveled by sledge. So not only on frozen rivers, but also on the frozen landscape. These are Scandinavians, of course. They're not just mariners. They are perfectly used to transferring themselves and moving across, traversing a frozen, snowy landscape. So using riverboats, using sledges, they are moving along the river systems of what we'd now call Eastern Europe, the western part of the Eurasian landmass, and they are connecting with all the people there. They're trading, they're settling, they're raiding, they're slaving, and they're causing huge impact all the way down to the Black Sea and the Caspian.
Right, quick question here. Outstanding. First one is, do they know what's out there? Have they had contact before? Are they having, because somebody, has a cartographer gone before them, or have they just set off in not in long boats, but in new boats? Because these are big rivers, aren't they? These aren't, yes. this is not the Trent and Mersey Canal. Are the lifeblood of Central Europe. So do they know what's out there as they head off?
It's a bit of both, because as well as them moving to the south and the east, earlier than that, we know that Arab traders, Islamic traders, and middlemen from the Abbasid Caliphate, for example, which moves from Damascus to Baghdad in the 740s, 750s, are already trading up through these very same river systems, pushing north and west. So we find thousands and thousands of Arab silver coins on Gotland and in Sweden. Why? Because as Norse are moving southeast, so Islamic traders are moving northwest, and they're meeting each other on the river systems, on the Volga, for example, and they are trading. They're trading the forest products of the north, which is things like precious furs, amber, for example, and also the slaves that the Vikings are taking. We know of Arab writers in the 920s meeting Rus on the Volga, who they said were as tall as date palms. They'd never met people like them. And they're selling women on the riverbank to anybody that comes past and has the money available. So they are aware there's a world down here, because that world is also reaching up to them, and they want to corner the market and to move down and to do away with the middlemen and do direct contact with Constantinople and the Eastern Roman Empire and the Abbasid Caliphate based on Baghdad.
Something just went ping in my old grey mess, Martin, because there is... So those of you who have seen the film The 13th Warrior and are thinking, how does Antonio Banderas hook up with those Vikings? There you go. But also, there is an Islamic historian who goes up in the other directions, as you were saying. He observes the Rus and said they like drinking, they like defecating in the open, etc., etc. And he witnesses the death or the funeral of a Viking warlord, complete with the sacrifice of animals, yep, and even the slave girl who wants to die with, yes, her lord. And it's a fascinating, it is such a document that you think you are there.
Yes, it's the writing of Ibn Fadlan. Now, Ibn Fadlan was on a diplomatic mission which involved him going to the Volga Bulgars, who were a tribe living on the Volga, who'd recently converted to Islam and who wanted to have some assistance in developing Islam, building mosques and so on, and also fortifications. And they put out feelers to the Abbasid Caliphate, and there was this diplomatic mission to them, just as the Byzantines later would have diplomatic missions to the Rus on Crimea. We might come on to that in a moment. Yeah. What we now call Ukraine. Yes, Ibn Fadlan writes that dramatic and shocking story about, yes, they don't wash their hands after defecating or after having sex, he says. He's absolutely shocked about this. He describes these shocking scenes of the sacrifice of slaves accompanying the death of a Rus warrior. Because these people are people that he describes as the Rus, yeah, and they are known to the Byzantines by a similar name, and to Islamic writers as the Rus. And these seem to be Swedish Vikings who are forming political units in what we now call Russia, Ukraine and Belarus, which we now call Kyiv or Kiev, Kievan Rus. And it makes a state that by the year 1000 stretches all the way from the Baltic to the Black Sea and is the most powerful force in Eastern Europe. It is a little superpower. Can you have a little superpower? But anyway, it is certainly a very, very powerful state that's trading north to south and is fabulously wealthy.
And also, you've got these incredible cities on the side of the banks, haven't you? They set up. So don't think of an empire as all the land, you know, heading towards up the steep. But they've got these cities, somewhat like the Greeks would have around the Mediterranean, the Romans.
Yes.
They're almost city-states on the way through, so you can't get at them. So if you are, if you are the Hun, the Mongol, you can have a crack at them. But they're fortified settlements. You can't get at them, and so they are rest stops. But they are also centres of industry. And they are almost like little independent nations. So that's the influence as well, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And that's the genesis of Kievan Rus, that as they move into this area, they sometimes found a trading settlement, a defended one. They'll sometimes move into and become the dominant force in another one.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll conquer one that's already there. So, for example, Kiev may well originally have been a trading point of the Khazars, who are a tribe of the the steppe country around the Sea of Azov.
Yeah.
So basically, in one form or another, they set up these little satellite states, these little satellite towns, defended places around Novgorod, around Smolensk, and around Kyiv. And interesting, in Scandinavia, they describe this area using the old Norse term of Garðaríki. And Garðaríki is the kingdom of the towns, or Gavar, the place of the towns. So it's associated with these little trading settlements, defended settlements, that coalesce to eventually form one state under the most powerful dynasty that's based on Kyiv. But originally, they've been based on Novgorod.
And you see, if you've ever played the game Civilization, this is a classic case. You've got the Vikings going southwest and setting up civilizations. You've got, as you said, the caliphates going north. And then, of course, and I've just got on a huge trip with this, the Byzantines, the Holy Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, lots of purple. It's more purple than backstage at a Prince concert. When those two collide, I mean, you might have thought it would have been all manner of siege warfare and whatever, but actually, it is a meeting, if you like, of minds, and quite fascinating what happens.
It is. Now, it starts off violently. So we do have evidence of Rus Viking attempts to besiege Constantinople. They can't take it. It's too powerful.
Yeah.
But they siege to it three, maybe four times, cause an awful lot of trouble, burn suburbs, basically negotiating by violence. And part of this, once they realize they cannot conquer Constantinople, and it was out of their league.
Yeah.
It is this amazing city. They call it the Great City. But once they realize that, we're not going to be able to conquer this place, obviously, they then begin to negotiate using violence. In other words, we'll use an awful lot of violence, we'll cause an awful lot of trouble, and will you in return buy us off by giving us trading arrangements so we can come into Constantinople and trade? And the Byzantines eventually think, well, okay, yeah, A, it buys them off, and B, we want these forest products, etc. And we also want a channel of our own silk products, for example, going to the northern world. And we're having trouble with some of our vassal states on the northern side of the Black Sea and in Crimea. And if we make an alliance with these rather rough and ready Kievan Rus, they will help us with people like the Pechenegs, the Cumans, and other tribes that sometimes we have some problems with in terms of our geopolitics around the Black Sea, and we can be useful to each other. My enemy's enemy will become my friend, and this alliance forms. So much so that in 988, Vladimir the Great of the Rus converts to Orthodox Christianity on Crimea as his plugging into the ideological base of the southern superpower of the Eastern Roman Empire. Now he's a Christian ruler.
And let us not forget, and here we come, one of my favourite units of the whole history of warfare, the Varangian Guards.
Exactly, exactly so. Because people like Harald Hardrada, who you've mentioned earlier, and a number of other people who've been forced out of Scandinavia for one reason or another and go off to sell their swords to the highest bidder, they're going to go to the superpower of the age. And the superpower of the age, although much diminished from its heyday, is nevertheless still the Byzantine Empire. And these are co-religionists because by this time Scandinavia is converting to Christianity, albeit of the Catholic version rather than the Orthodox version. So they sort of feel that's okay. And so the Rus agree to provide mercenary troops for the Varangian Guard and other elite Norse, like Harald Hardrada, before he's killed at Stamford Bridge in the early autumn of 1066, is down there in Constantinople trying his luck, bringing in some money, becoming quite famous.
Famous. He gets in all sorts of things. They don't want him to leave. He marries a local. Is it Rose? Because Byzantines are always bumping each other off in true Roman style. But there's an elder woman who, the wife of one of the emperors, takes a shine to him, and there's all sorts of, it's a sort of please don't go. And he ends up getting thrown in with two of his mates, one of who's very tall. One who's very short. So Tolkien loved this sort of thing because it's basically Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas. And they get thrown into this very dark prison, don't they? Which has got a huge serpent in it, according to folklore.
Yeah, so what we've got here is we've got this strange mixture of reality that really did happen. He was there, he was doing stuff, and we've got records of it that emerge particularly in Iceland and in Norway in the late 12th and 13th century, as these tales tend to get written down and get bigger and bigger and bigger in the telling. And in the final version, he's involved in a love triangle with an Eastern Roman empress. He helps overthrow an emperor and install another, and we're just not sure how much of this really is happening. But what we do know is he really was there. So, for example, he went to Jerusalem and he later boasted that he had protected the road from the Jordan to Jerusalem from bandits. This is a Viking doing police operations in the vicinity of the Jordan between Jerusalem and the river. And you're thinking, what? Is this even possible? And that certainly happened.
But you see, this is the thing, because we tend to think, and it's only now that we are realising the interconnection, and they do get around, people pop up all over the place. I mean, they really do. It's not, the Vikings aren't just, people refer to this as the Dark Ages, for goodness sake, and it's anything but. I'm sitting in southern Spain, at the same time this time, we've got the caliphates going off left, right and centre as well, El Cid, it's a fascinating period of time. However, whilst we're getting carried away with the boys' own adventure stuff, which I love, you can tell. But if you think of the way the Eastern Orthodox Church is formed, and some of the stuff that happens in an Orthodox service, and some of the imagery and the symbolism, have another look, because there's an awful lot of Viking footprint there, if you like.
There's a whole conversation of cultures going on here throughout this early medieval period. And just one little side about the connectedness. What we haven't talked about is how the western end of the Silk Roads basically come in to the Volga area, to the Caspian. So these Rus who are forming Kievan Rus, this state, they're not just connecting with Byzantine Empire. They're not just connecting with the incredibly sophisticated and very forward and rich Abbasid caliphate now based on Baghdad. They're also plugging into the western end of the Silk Road, such that we have in Sweden, for example, in one of the trading settlements, a little figure of Buddha found in an early medieval context that we think was made in the Swat Valley of Pakistan.
Yeah.
Now, because, how's that possible? Because the East is also connecting with the West. From Japan in the Far East, right the way through to Scandinavia, we have this interconnected hand-over-hand connection. And that's why when we look at things like, as you said, the way in which services are done, the way in which ritual is practiced, we often find there's borrowings from one culture to another, albeit it will be adapted and changed, because these people are part of a multi-ethnic conversation.
And not only that, though, when you think Marco Polo, for example, They're not on their own. It's not him and a donkey. This is basically the M25. There are people going back and there are caravans going back and forth all the time. So when you think of the Silk Road and the connectivity, it's not one guy setting off going, I will go to Pakistan. This is happening all the time. You know, there'll be another caravan around next week. So that is why it's the volume. That one Buddha you found hasn't been cherished. It's just happened to fall off the back of a truck somewhere, literally. Yes. So don't be thinking that there's, again, connectivity, which we're only kind of really getting into the whole connectivity of the of how the whole of, there wasn't a line saying this is Western Europe, you can't go any further because you'll ruin our narrative, basically, Martin.
Exactly. I mean, in the 840s, the director of post of the Abbasid Caliphate collects together some intelligence and formed a document, and he says that Rus appeared on camels in Baghdad.
Oh, brilliant.
He then talked...
Camel-riding Vikings. Who had that on their bingo card? Who had that on their bingo card?
I have a chapter in the book called Vikings on Camels, because they're there. The same guy, Kordadbe, who's this director of post, also gets really interested in the Rus, and he looks at other intelligence reports that are coming to him, because basically he is this kind of intelligence gatherer. And he says, well, some people are reporting these Rus are appearing in Syria. Some say they've got as far as Egypt. There's stories of them sailing through the Persian Gulf. And then he says, I've got one report here that says they appear in an area which, and we're not quite sure whether he's talking about Western Tang China or the regions of the Uyghurs in Central Asia. So Marco Polo, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
It is actually possible that some of these Rus traders at some point or another managed to reach Tang China, certainly the lands of the Uyghurs, and that is all part of the story.
The thing is, it's an oral culture. This is the problem, isn't it? It's sagas. It's passed down. It's embroidered. Yeah. So had they bothered to sort of put pen to paper, we might have had a different look at this. We've got 5 minutes before I crash the news. How does, because it's called, I mean, you could have just said Vikings in the East, and you've got me on that one. But from Vladimir the Great to Vladimir Putin. So how does Putin come into, I mean, many of us would wish he was on the front of a longboat or getting spread eagle. Spread eagles never actually happened to people, but just to let you know. So what is the connection then between Putin and, is he claiming that, because he's been channeling his Peter the Great. So how is he channeling his Vladimir the Great?
Okay, in 1240, Kiev is devastated by the Mongols, and the center of gravity shifts to Muscovy and Moscow. And from then onwards, this emerging polity of what will become Russia claims to have inherited everything that Kiev and Kievan Rus stood for. So from Ivan the Great in the 16th century onwards, rulers of Moscow have said, we lay claim to everything that Kiev once had. Holy Russia, this dominant force, this connection with the East and with the South, that's part of our story too, this deep story. And that denies then the autonomy of, if you like, Ukraine and the Ukrainian lands. So in 1783, for example, Catherine the Great takes Crimea as part of this push down. Other czars are involved in the Russification of Ukraine in the 19th century and in the 20th century. This is a deep story which Russians use to say there is only one Russia that includes Ukraine, whether they like it or not, and they need to come under the auspices of us. They need to come home. And that's why in 2015, having taken Crimea in 2014, Putin said Crimea has sacred meaning for Russia, like a temple mount for Jews and Muslims. Why? Because Vladimir the Great was baptized there in 988. In 2016, he puts up a huge statue in Borovitskaya Square in central Moscow to Vladimir the Great. And he makes sure it's a taller statue than the one in Kiev. Yeah. In 2021, on the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians, he says, we are just reuniting the Rus lands that were broken by history. They need to come under us. And in February 2024, he says the same thing to Tucker Carlson, who's clearly rather bemused by it. And in June 2024, at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, he says, look, we are Europeans. We come from this Viking heritage. They've lost those genes now. European culture in its traditional form is what we now represent. That part of Europe called Western has lost it. We've now got it because our roots go back to this 1,000-year-old connectivity with Scandinavia and this Norse Slavic state. He is claiming that Ukraine is simply part of Russia, and that Russia now represents everything of Western values that he now claims that Russia, in its traditional terms, Holy Russia, now represents. He is deeply invested in this deep story.
As you can tell, I could probably talk to you about that. I could go on now and go, okay, well, what about the Great Northern War and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and Peter the Great and Charles and all that sort of thing? Sweeten that list, because I only do this show and it goes all morning. Otherwise, we'll be here until next Wednesday. but it's absolutely brilliant and fascinating. The book is called Vikings on the East. Listeners, go forth to the webpage, click on it, like I'm going to do in a minute, and it will come winging its way to you. Martin, if people want to find you online and find out, because it's just fascinating and mind-blowing, where can they find you? Or do you do the social media? Have you a website? Where can they find you?
Yes, they'll find me on Twitter, X, at Martin Historian. They'll find me on things like Threads as well. I'm even down with the kids a little bit on TikTok.
Oh, for goodness sake, Martin. Yes. What would Vladimir the Great do with TikTok, ask yourself?
And on Instagram, yes. So if you put in Martin Whittock or at Martin Historian or Martin Historian.
And that's with a Y. That's with a Y as well, isn't it?
Yeah, with a Y. You'll find me there somewhere in the great world of the World Wide Web.
Looking eastward. I'm going to run out of time. But Martin Whittock, as you can tell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been great to talk to you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.